Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
My name is Heath Brown, and I'm really interested in how and why people get along and create great scholarship together. This is the co-authored podcast where we look behind the curtain and learn how scholars of politics collaborate, one project at a time.
In this episode of the co-authored podcast, we focus on the hard parts of collaboration. As COVID-19 hit the United States, a number of people asked me about collaborating during crises, public health or otherwise. I focus here on just that, how collaborations happen or don't during difficult times. We start in the 1970s with the early days of the AIDS crisis, then move forward to the early 2000s and end up where we are today. We hear first from Ken Sherrill.
In 1972, I began studying the gay rights movement. I did a study of the leaders and the rank and file members of an organization called the Gay Activists Alliance in New York, which was an organization formed shortly after Stonewall, until I discovered I couldn't publish my work because people thought it wasn't political science.
But Ken was not merely someone trying to get his work published. He was a practicing political scientist as well.
In 1977, a vacancy arose that struck me as being perfect. Jerry Nadler, like two doors away neighbor, was the Democratic district leader on the Upper West Side. He was elected to the state assembly. Under reform rules, you could not hold a party position like district leader and a legislative position. Jerry was elected in 76. And in 77, there was a primary to fill that vacancy. There had been an interim person chosen by the county committee, but I ran and I got elected. So I became New York's first openly gay elected official.
This is Ken Sherrill, emeritus professor of political science from Hunter College, wearer of many hats, scholar, activist, elected official, party boss. He had a first row seat to what transpired in the late 1970s and 1980s in New York City and elsewhere.
We didn't know anything about AIDS. It was first discovered in 1981, or a disease that we couldn't name, not quite the crime that we can't name, but a disease that we couldn't name. It was originally GRID, gay-related infectious disease, because the disease was being found among gay men. People were really afraid to talk about it. I can't tell you how taboo it was. In 84, I was a delegate, a Mondale delegate to the Democratic National Convention. The caucus of openly gay delegates was, you know, small enough to meet in a hotel suite. And we had fights. Our big fight was to get something about non-discrimination into a platform. But I learned in 84 in San Francisco the way in which the gay medical community was fighting with Mayor Feinstein about public health measures and, you know, how incredibly sex negative Feinstein was at the time. Yes, she was advanced compared to other big city mayors, but compared to the knees in San Francisco and the level of political organizing in the gay community in San Francisco, the responses were minimal.
This was the atmosphere in which the public health system and public officials addressed the early AIDS crisis: fear, confusion, and bigotry. In the social sciences, things weren't much different.
There was ignorance in the public opinion research community about how to study these populations, how to ask questions about the disease, and fear of what would happen if you asked those questions, fear that people would refuse to answer, fear that funders would be offended, fear that future research might be jeopardized. My guess it was that Gallup was big enough to know they could get away with it. And it was certainly, by then, newsworthy. I do not remember what they found or in what context they put it. I think they asked, do you know someone who has it? I don't know if they asked anything about what do you think should be done about it.
There would be consequences to even asking about the crisis, let alone collaborating with colleagues or a graduate student. This atmosphere limited the contributions political scientists could make to this issue, prevented doctoral students from studying the topic, and resulted in almost no publishing on the subject in flagship political science journals.
Why were universities behind the curve? Well, a lot of bright young gay faculty were dying. Can't tell you what was the overwhelming impact of that was. The academic job market was lousy, and the last thing that anybody writing a dissertation or in graduate school needed to do was to burden his or her CV with something about AIDS. In her way, this is why Kent Jennings and Ellen Anderson was so important. I mean, to get an article published, co-authored with Ken Jennings, conferred a respectability and a dignity. You don't refuse to interview somebody who's co-authored with Ken Jennings, but there weren't many Ken Jennings around. There were very few senior people who were prepared to put themselves on the line. People didn't get jobs. People couldn't take the risk of writing papers and giving them at conferences or putting them on their CVs. And that, I think, was particularly the case in American politics.
To be clear, Ken is not a pessimist. He lived through this public health crisis, and he shares stories of hope within universities and associations, ways that institutions began to take seriously the AIDS crisis, but also the underlying hatred and discrimination that it exposed. Ken was still at Hunter College during this period, and Donna Shalala, future cabinet secretary and member of Congress, was the college president. He explains how he has come to think about this period, how the college responded, as well as how select few scholars collaborated during this period.
Donna was succeeded as president by Paul LeClaire, who had worked at 80th Street and then became provost at Baruch. And he was a French scholar. He collaborated on a 2 or 3 volume series with someone who died of AIDS. And Paul, when he became president, dedicated himself to having the college do something about AIDS. It was really wonderful. A gay guy who had chaired the English department proposed and made it happen. That the first essay in expository writing in freshman English be an essay about AIDS, so that students would learn immediately that it was something legitimate to talk about and to read about and to write about, that it wasn't taboo. that we could inject the language and the ideas into college life in a way that immediately affected the entire freshman class. You know, a light bulb went off for me a couple of years ago that what caused shared fate and shared identity was AIDS. Before AIDS, successful, well-to-do gay people, gay men, felt kind of embarrassed to be around the flamboyant militant and, thought that their position protected them from discrimination. AIDS changed all of that. You couldn't be rich enough to avoid getting AIDS.
Some collaboration persists through tragedy on a national, even global scale. Other collaborations are much smaller, more individual, but still really important. Fast forward 20 years. It is now the mid-aughts, and we are in Northern California. Of the luminaries who sat on the faculty there at the University of California, Berkeley, at the time, was Professor Nelson Polsby. 15 books, editor of the American Political Science Review, called funny, brilliant, witty, larger than life by his colleagues. This is David Hopkins, now a professor at Boston College and a graduate student there at the time.
Somehow, once I got to Berkeley, right away, I really hit it off with Nelson. And Nelson was a very strong personality. The thing about Nelson's office, Nelson had an office like nobody else. Most academic offices, have one door and it's closed most of the time and there's someone inside silently working. And Nelson hated that. That was not his idea of how an office should be. His office had three doors, and it was right in the middle between the library and the hallway, and there were people passing through all the time. And most people's idea, I think, as academics, would be that this would be torture, and this was exactly how Nelson loved it.
With the central office serving as a town square, Polsby could listen to the conversations the way he did when he studied Congress, engaging in conversations with legislators to learn how they worked. It was this orientation to other people that explains a lot about how he collaborated. Here's Dave again.
No one who was a graduate student or faculty member at Berkeley during the time Nelson was there will ever forget T. Nelson spent a year at Oxford, I think it was sometime in the 80s or early 90s, and came back to Berkeley and decided that what we needed was tea every day at 3 o'clock. And the idea was that this would be an opportunity for people to interact socially and to sort of kibitz with each other, as he would say. And his idea was that helped build a community, and it also helped foster collaboration. Graduate students and faculty might start talking about ideas that they had. And I certainly had more than one paper that came out of getting into a conversation with someone at T. And the first thing I learned about being his research assistant is that my job was just sort of basically to hang around. There would be some days there would be work to do. There would be other days where there wouldn't be work to do, but he just wanted me around, and he wanted his other RAs just around to talk to and to keep him company and to laugh at his jokes and to be there in case, he needed to figure out how to work Google or something like that. Nelson was a social person. He used to say, most academics are cats and I am a dog.
Having tea every day at 3, hanging around the office, led to the collaboration on the textbook, Presidential Elections. Interestingly, a textbook that had already lost one colossal scholar, Aaron Woldofsky, a decade earlier.
I asked Nelson one time, Nelson spoke about Aaron a lot. Aaron was really a dear friend of his. And Aaron was the one who had brought him to Berkeley when Nelson had been at Wesleyan. And he really often spoke very kindly of Aaron. And this was a characteristic trait of Nelson's, that he would just talk about people you didn't know, kind of as if you already knew them. And then the more he talked about them, the more you felt like maybe you did know them. And he really had a very kind feelings about Aaron and really saw the book as as in some ways a tribute to their collaboration and their just their friendship and their partnership over so many years.
Books that are reissued over long periods of time inevitably deal with retirements and death. And finding new co-authors is one of the things scholars must do.
I was kind of a natural fit to help him out with the presidential elections textbook, which I had read as an undergraduate, and it's how I had heard of him before I came to be his RA, as I already knew the book. I started working on the 11th edition pretty soon after I arrived, and then I was still around when it was time to start the 12th edition, because, of course, as a presidential elections textbook, you need a new edition every 4 years to keep up with the latest election. So we were on a kind of a four-year schedule. We were working on the 12th edition around 2006, and this is around the time when Nelson's health was failing. And while we didn't know exactly when or what was going to happen, everyone who's around Nelson, you know, you couldn't help but be aware that he was increasingly having health trouble. He had been in the hospital a couple of times. And so, you know, that was, I think, in my mind, although we had no way of knowing exactly what was going to happen. And Nelson himself, as much as he could, was still full speed ahead. You know, he never, he acknowledged as little as possible the problems he was having. He was still excited about the book and excited about the work. And he was just going to keep going as long as he could.
Following Polsby's passing, there remained a question of what to do with the textbook, add a new set of authors, or discontinue the book.
What ended up happening is that we finished the manuscript for the 12th edition very, very soon before Nelson died in early 2007. And so the book was sort of in the works at the publisher at that point. But the work had basically been done. Nelson and I had sort of signed off on a final version for the what was going to be the 2008 edition of the book. And then at some point, and I don't remember exactly in retrospect when it was, but at some point after Nelson died, the publisher reached out to the Polsby family and said, if you have any interest, we would like to keep this book going. We like the book. We think the book should continue. It's an important book for the field. And, you know, what would you say to that? And it was really Linda Polsby and the Polsby family, I think, who said that I should be someone who should be involved going forward. I was still a graduate student at the time. I was not someone who was on anyone's radar as someone to, you know, to take up the mantle of such a well-known book by two such eminent authors. But the publisher also suggested Steve Scheer as someone who would help out. And Steve and I have now ourselves built a collaboration on this book, keeping the book going for now three successive editions after that. So it just sort of worked out that that I in a sense inherited this role to keep this collaboration going, but it's certainly nothing that I did. It's the kindness of the Polsby family as wanting to keep me in the mix that made that possible.
Nelson Polsby's death was not a major surprise. Keeping the textbook going was only possible because this collaboration had already begun. They'd been working on the project and had built the connections and trust. Family, usually far from academic collaborations, all of a sudden became incredibly important to sustaining the work. The family trusted that Dave would be able to continue the textbook into the future, and that's what he's done.
It's a tricky thing to keep a book like this going because things do change. And the book has to reflect change. I remember when I was working with Nelson, I could always get him to put something else in the book. It was always taking things out that was more of a struggle. He wanted to tell the story about how George McGovern had, you know, outwitted Ed Muskie in New Hampshire in 1972 and this sort of thing. And at some point saying, well, gee, Nelson, this is ancient history to the undergraduates of today. He thought, well, they should learn all of this stuff. They should learn about Gary Hart and Walter Mondale. They should learn about Estes Kefauver in the 1950s. And so on the one hand, we have had to make some decisions because the book can't just keep getting bigger, of taking some things out where I know the Nelson's voice in my head says, oh, gee, I wish we could leave that in. In the last 13 years, I often think about, well, what would Nelson say about these things? The rise of Donald Trump, for example, Nelson would have been the first to claim credit for seeing Trump coming, you know, that his idea about nominations were that they were open to these sort of populist figures. This was an old idea of Nelson's going back to his work in the 70s and 80s on nominations.
Nelson Polsby's passing was painful for everyone involved, but it was not unexpected. On some level, it sounds like they knew it was coming and had already begun planning for his death. Other tragedies happen earlier in life, are sudden, unexpected, leaving collaborators truly reeling. We hear next from Julia Azari, a professor at Marquette University. She describes the friendship and collaboration with Jennifer Smith, a professor at Deep Springs College who passed away in 2018. The two were both graduate students at Yale. Here's Julia describing their first meaningful encounter.
We both ended up attending one of the first IQRM qualitative methods workshop, which at the time was held at Arizona State in Tempe, Arizona. And we had maybe met in passing. We had a lot of common friends, but we had maybe met once in passing. And we were assigned to room together for that 10-day period in Arizona, which we often talked about how odd that was that they made that decision that two people from the same institution had not requested each other as roommates, but they still put us together. I mean, in this case, we just happened not to really know each other, but there could have been a lot of other backstories to that.
Life is like that. And the coincidences didn't stop there for these two. Though they hadn't collaborated at Yale, once they landed close by in Wisconsin, a friendship and collaboration began.
And she moved to Milwaukee in, I guess that would be fall of 2005. Well, as our intrepid listeners may know, I just said I'm at Marquette, so I'm talking to you from Milwaukee, where I've been living since 2007. So essentially, we reunited when I ended up moving to Milwaukee. You know, she was the person I talked to when I was thinking about accepting this position, and it kind of walked me through Milwaukee and like helped me move into my apartment on short notice. And then we started hanging out a lot together once I started my position at Marquette in 2007. And during the time that she was also on the faculty at UWM, we wrote this 2012 paper in Perspectives on Politics together on informal institutions. We had presented it at APSA in 2008. We roomed together at APSA sometimes. And that collaboration was a successful one. Things kind of started to get complicated around that time that paper.
When you talk to people about why they collaborate, the sense of tension comes up a lot. Collaborations often seem to happen between people who are different. It is often these differences of perspective or method or style that make the work great. But they also sometimes strain the relationships underlying the teamwork. Here's Julia again.
There were ways in which our different work styles were really helpful. One of the funnier ones, I think, is that Jenny was a night person. I'm just not going to ever get the tense right exactly as I talk about her. And she would, especially, you know, in the summer when you have a flexible schedule, would be up all night writing. And I am more of an early person, and I'll get up if I'm really writing, you know, 6 or 7, not crazy early, but early. And so we actually had a stretch where I think we were working on our paper in sort of like 24 hour, you know, someone was always working on it. And we did our final push to turn our revisions into Perspectives on Politics in the middle of this heat wave in Milwaukee in 2011, where Jenny had a beautiful condo near the lake here in Milwaukee. But a feature of beautiful older buildings in Milwaukee is often that they don't have air conditioning, whereas I have the sort of decrepit air conditioning that's about the same age as I am. So of the two of us, I was in a slightly better position. So she actually came over, stayed in my guest room, and we did our final revisions with my husband and my cats surrounding us. And Jenny was actually kind of the person who developed some of, as we both worked on the theory, but here I think she maybe did more because she was the one who did most of the work linking this to some ideas in comparative politics. And also she was the one who really incorporated some material at the beginning about norms violations in Wisconsin politics, which was a very fresh story in 2010, and apparently is also really a fresh story now. Throughout this moment we're in right now with this the pandemic and the crazy politics, it's not just that I wish that I could get her take. It's that it's this big thing that she'll never know about.
Collaborations head in many directions. The paper they had been working on came out in Perspectives in 2012 and has been cited over 100 times since. It has been mentioned by journalists and bloggers as key to understanding the key developments of the last decade. She may not be around to comment on what's happening today, but the article in Perspectives remains a major part of the legacy of this collaboration. One of the most common things I've heard about is the difficulty of collaborating across types of institutions, when the expectations and resources start to diverge greatly and collaborators face very different circumstances. But these changes are nothing compared to when health fails. Here's Julia again.
As sometimes happens in academia, she did not get tenure. Her book did not end up getting published, and I don't totally know the whole story behind that, but it never ended up getting published, and so she didn't get tenure at UWM. She stayed there for a year, I think a year beyond her terminal year, as a visitor, and then spent a year as a visitor at Wesleyan, and then landed this position at Deep Springs College in California, right on the border with Nevada, in a geographical location I had never envisioned in my life. And that put her on a kind of strange research trajectory. But as this was happening in the beginning part of this, in 2012, she had been denied. And this is just, you couldn't imagine worse timing for a pair of collaborators and friends. But for me, this was actually a really positive, 2012 was a really positive turning point in my career. You know, it wasn't exactly clear how we were going to execute this next project. Eventually, we came to the conclusion that she was going to be the lead author. This is a project on anti-partyism, which we never published, and I don't think we, you know, I don't think I'm ever going to be able to really return to that project. I'll probably have something in my own book that acknowledges it, but my thinking on the subject has somewhat evolved, and here's basically what happened. As we worked on that for quite a bit, we presented it at a conference. She went through all these complicated career transitions. She was really happy at Deep Springs, but it's a very remote location. It's a tiny college. It's 15 students. It's a working ranch. It's a totally different place. And so it doesn't have a library. But she was trying to work on this paper, and we actually got a really encouraging revise and resubmit from a journal we were really excited about. And this happened about 7 months before she got diagnosed. I mean, so that's what happened. We had this project in the works. It was looking like a really promising thing, particularly for her, because she was eventually going to have to go on the market again. We had just met up at APSA in 2015 and made a pretty aggressive plan to get our revisions finished. And I remember there was something, I don't remember what it was. There was something that like she kind of needed to do before I could do my part, right? This is a sort of classic co-author thing where like, I need you to write the section on blah, blah, blah before I can investigate civic republicanism or whatever it was. And so I have this sort of chain of emails where I'm trying not to harangue her, but also trying to sort of clarify the order in which we need to do things. And that chain of emails ends with her saying, I have cancer. It was definitely out of the blue, right? So this is, you know, at the time she was 40, she was a, you know, healthy person living, as I said, on this ranch with her students out west, like, you know, hiking all the time. And not that that inoculates you from, obviously, from illness, but you know what I mean? Like that was sort of my vision of her and very young.
This news came at such an early point in life. Living in a new place, at a new college, with new colleagues and students and expectations, but also with old friends and colleagues that had to figure out what would happen next.
We had a chance to talk about things that were important, and I think, I don't remember us ever having a big conversation, but I think to forgive each other for some of the things we were frustrated about, and we were, I think, ready to finish this paper and move on with our friendship, and maybe move on with our friendship in a way that didn't necessarily involve a lot of research collaborating. Part of the reason for that is that when she was at Deep Springs, it's really a teaching place, and I think she really reconnected. She loves teaching, and she was a wonderful teacher, and I think she was coming to terms with the fact that that was something that really worked for her, and being on the research treadmill wasn't, even though she was brilliant. I haven't said that in this conversation, but this is like the first thing anyone who knew her will tell you, is she was the kind of brilliant that stands out in a seminar, you know, in a graduate seminar where everyone's very smart. That doesn't mean that the research treadmill is for you. And I think it just, you know, didn't make her happy. But I don't know. I don't know what the, you know, what that would have looked like, because, as I said, we did end up, you know, we have this series of emails that are, what are you doing? What am I doing? Here's what I kind of need from you before I could do my part. I'm trying to carve out time and make my schedule. Do you have any idea when you maybe might be able to kind of look at the thing? And then there's an email, you know, I'm having a bit of a health scare, but once that's over, I'll, you know, take a look at whatever. And then, as I said, the email ends with her having cancer. And the reality of this email thread really impeded my ability to get back to this paper, to be honest. You asked if I reread it or if I ever wanted to look at it. And the answer is I never did. And this was while she was alive. And we were really trying to finish the paper. And the editor very generously gave us lots of extensions and was very understanding. And we were really talking about finishing it, but we never did. And, you know, some of the reason I never dug back into it is because we had this long thread about all the, you know, here's our game plan, and it turned into such a upsetting thread. She would email me, or occasionally we would see each other, and she would say, we should really finish this paper, we're so close. We had really, like, the most probably generous, light R&R I've ever had at a journal. And I just couldn't face it on my own, and I didn't want to bug her about it, and I couldn't really tell if she cared or not. Does that make sense? And there were so many things. I mean, some of it was she, as I said, was really enjoying the teaching, and I can't emphasize enough how much she loved being at Deep Springs College for those last years of her life, and how much she enjoyed the students there, and throwing herself into that work, and really narrowing down what was important to her, and that it was clear that, like, research just wasn't it. And the only time we talked about this was a couple days before she died, when I was there, and she was with her parents in Kentucky, and I was there, and we were talking about some economist who had, like, finished a bunch of papers on his deathbed, and she just kind of said, yeah, that's not me. And we just kind of laughed about it, which sounds kind of weird, but we laughed a lot the last time I saw her. But up until that point, we did not really talk about her dying. You know, we just had conversations that had no temporality to them. Which meant I never asked her, you know, what do you want me to do with this paper? I never asked her, what do you want me to do when I talk about our other paper? Which is important to me when we talk about that paper. Like, I don't want every conversation to be about her passing or about me making it about that aspect of it, but I also don't want her to be forgotten as we talk about the, you know, the perspectives paper. We really never, we just kept having the same conversation over for 3 years with this anti-parties paper that we had an R&R on. We, you know, we should really finish that. We're so close. We should do it. You know, I'll put it on my calendar.
Loss at such an early point in life, at the start of a career, is painful and complicated. It doesn't always lead neatly to the next project. It isn't always clear what the person who has been lost would want with unfinished work, unpublished papers, and books. It was clear that Jennifer Smith preferred to laugh at the end, not obsess over what was to become of her research. Others are different and hope for everything to be wrapped up before they go. During the COVID pandemic, more of us are considering these questions. What will happen in the future never feels more uncertain
And already, most of us know someone who has died from coronavirus. This episode reminds me of the different ways we make sense of loss and the ways we grieve for former collaborators, mourn the loss of people and the ideas that inspired them. I hope you've learned something from this episode too. Supporting this co-authored podcast are the American Political Science Association, John Jay College, and the New Books Network. Thank you for listening.